Hi, folks, and thank you for tuning in today. I'm Henrik Hallengren, and this is Red Ice Radio. RedIceCreations.com and RedIceRadio.net is where you can find a lot more of what we do. It's always an honor that you want to spend some of your time with us as we learn more and more about the beast that we are fighting, its properties, its strengths and weaknesses, all in order to effectively take it down and liberate the world and move towards a society that takes all people into account, allowing each and every group and people and ethnicity and race to decide their own fate and live according to their own principles, culture, religion, values, and everything else. You see, the monster that we are fighting claims that it's for human rights, diversity, and equality. But actually, it is not. This is just rhetoric. It is using these words and this method as a way to disarm you and make you think that the system has the issues of freedom and fairness and equality and all this bullshit covered. But as you know, if you're a regular listener, this is not the case. The system has been hijacked and now run on lies, fraud, and deceit, and a very different agenda than what most people think. We are fighting against displacement of our people, of people in my country, Sweden, in all European countries, and also all countries that were founded and built by Europeans. If you think colonialism is wrong, then you should also be against the neocolonialism that we are seeing with the massive populations that are leaving their countries, in some cases fleeing both from bad conditions, but also wars created not by our fruition, but conservatives, neocons, and those who run AIPAC and similar organizations in the US and the EU. And ironically, they're all backed up by the left as well. But the point is that this is by force, and the people who are subjected to this on both ends have not been asked about any of this, and they're not allowed to be part of the decision-making. Our interests are no longer being looked after. They don't care about you. We are being bulldozed over by the politicians and those who lobby them, and of course their hateful policies designed to make us minorities in our own countries. As bad as it might be for the people leaving certain countries, they at least have their people there to return to, if and when they please. We do not have that. We do no longer have our own countries. If we do not change this and turn this around, our demographic makeup will forever be changed and never be returned to the state that it once was. Now, if you are for diversity, true diversity, where we have many cultures on the earth with different people, different customs, different backgrounds, culture, heritage, ethnicity, all of that good stuff, you should be against the kind of monoculture that those who seek to destroy us is now forcing down our throats. There's a lot that can be said about the hypocrisy, double standards, and flat-out unacceptable policies that are enforced on our people. But we're going to leave some of this to our guest to talk more about here today, perhaps from a bit of a different perspective than me, but we have a lot in common and have goals very similar and fight for the same things. Our guest is Matthew Heimbach from Trad Youth Network, or Traditionalist Youth Network. Matthew is one of these guys that I've been vehemently vilified in the media, so I thought it would be fun to bring Matthew on and actually talk with him one-on-one and see what the fuss is all about. We're going to talk a bit about his background in the beginning, so I'm not going to go through the entire story here. But what I think you should know about Matthew is that he was instrumental in trying to get a white student union started at Towson University in 2009. And why this is such an important move and a strategically brilliant move by Matthew and those who helped him out with this is that it displays our detractors' inability to treat us on an equal basis. That what they do and have is something that we also should be able to do and have. But that is not so. We are treated differently. We are put in a different category. And I personally don't have a need for equality or that everything needs to be equal at all times. We are not equal, and hence trying to enforce that equality is just going to make things much, much worse than they already are. It's something that's going to end very, very badly, and those who know history understand that as well. But if you've been paying attention, you know that this is what the leftists and the so-called conservatives alike are pushing in our times. Equality is one of the highest virtues. So what's funny about this then is that it shows that it's not about equality, because they don't believe in it, especially not for white people. Equality is a weapon that is being used against us because they want to win. And there's nothing wrong with wanting to win. That's all fine and good. But many of these people would never admit that they are competing. They would like to have you believe that their agenda is simply to eliminate evil from the world. But forcing and pushing towards this equality and towards this end, they have and do perform some of the most evil acts we have ever seen. Just in the same way as they claim they bring love, there is an awful lot of hate in these people. And it's becoming more and more clear each day that this hate is consuming them in their attempt to destroy who we are. But that's enough of my rant. Let's get to our guest, everybody. Stay tuned. Interesting interview up ahead. Hi, Matthew. Great to have you here. Thank you so much for coming on with us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you. There's a lot of things I want to ask you about today, a lot of things to cover and get into. You have an interesting background, of course. You've been involved in this, I don't know how many years. You can bring us up to speed, I guess, a little bit here as well. For those who don't know, Matthew, tell us just a little bit about yourself and, of course, the Traditionalist Youth Network and how you got drawn towards where you are today.
Sure. Well, I grew up in a small town in Western Maryland. And I was raised in a very normal conservative home. My parents are not radical in any way, shape, or form. They're very mainstream Republicans and conservatives. But I was raised in kind of the foundations of, what we like to call it trad youth, of faith, family, and folk. To understand the importance of my immediate family, to love my local culture, and to have an appreciation for faith. My mother and grandmother especially are very devoted Catholics, so I was kind of raised in that very normal environment, something that would, anywhere in the Western world would be considered normal and average in any period of history prior to this one. So kind of with that background, when I went to college, I saw what was just kind of an amazing far-left agenda on campus. So I got involved with a group called Youth for Western Civilization, and started a chapter, and I became the chapter president. And we did a series of events to be able to kind of tackle leftism on campus. There wasn't really a racial element to it, but it was just kind of the old left versus right, and there were no right forces on the campus. The local college Republicans who were at Towson University, the college I went to, were actually more leftist than the Democrats. It was almost like they were kind of seeking the approval of the establishment, where they had an open homosexual Asian as the second in command of the college Republicans. And even we would want to talk about immigration, because in Maryland at the time when I was going to school, there was a debate in our state legislature about in-state tuition for illegal immigrants. Now, about a third of the Towson University population came from either Pennsylvania or New York or Virginia, some of the local states. And they were paying twice as much in tuition as a normal Maryland student would. So there is this bill for illegal immigrants, people who shouldn't even be in the country in the first place, being offered in-state tuition when if someone lived 1 mile over the Pennsylvania border, they were being forced to pay twice as much. So we tried to say, well, we should maybe tackle this issue and do some activism for it. And the Republicans said, well, that would be racist. And we can't do that. That's a sort of issue that you can take it from a purely civic nationalist perspective. You don't even need to get into race on why the idea of citizens of your nation are getting second place status and illegal immigrants are getting preferred status as to why you should be offended. But that kind of started me thinking. It was kind of funny. I tried to be a normal, good, conservative, colorblind, all those sorts of things. But the Republicans and then the far left actually did more to radicalize me than anything that I did myself. You can only be called like a racist and a fascist so many times before you're eventually like, well, let's start doing some research and see what they're actually, accusing me of.
Exactly.
And,
yeah.
I know. I think I've been, if I had a dollar for every time I've been called a fascist, I definitely wouldn't have to be working anymore. But so we went through this period of, activism on my university campus with Youth for Western Civilization. And we had Black History Month at my college. And the Black Student Union that actually in the 60s, stormed the president of the university's office, and until they were given basically into their demands, which was space on campus and a huge budget to operate in every year. And the Black Student Union on campus actually just redid about it 2 or 3 years ago, a huge Black Panther painting on their wall. So, you know, this wasn't just like a area for Black students. It was filled with symbolism of Black radicalism. And I thought, you know, well, maybe we should talk about the double standards that are apparent on campus. And they wrote Black Power and Black Pride in chalk all around the campus during Black History Month. So YWC, we decided that let's just expose the double standard. And we took all the slogans that the Black Student Union had written on our campus and just changed the word black to white. So, you know, like white pride and celebrate white history and things like that. And then the news trucks arrived and they held several meetings with hundreds of students condemning us for being, again, evil, racist, fascist. Just for doing the exact same thing the Black Student Union did on campus, but saying the same thing for white students. So our university advisor was actually pressured to remove his support for YWC. So we were a SGA, Student Government Association, approved group, and we lost our affiliation because our advisor was forced out. So we all kind of sat around and said, well, you know, no one is standing up for the interests politically or socially of the white student body at Towson University. And one of the biggest things is every year, hundreds of dollars of your tuition would go to the Student Government Association to then go to ethnic advocacy groups. And there are literally dozens of ethnic advocacy groups. You know, the White Student Union was something that was not found. There was the Black Student Union, the Arab Student Union, the Asian Student Union, the Jewish Student Union, and the list went on and on. But there was no group, even though white students were paying the majority of all the fees to go to these other cultural groups, there was no voice for white students. So we decided that we were going to organize a white student union, which, of course, caused another uproar, even though we used the Black Student Union's constitution and statement of principles, once again changing the word black to white. And it became an actual kind of an international incident.
Yeah, I remember when it bloomed out. It was tragic and sad and hilarious to kind of watch it unfold at the same time. I mean, you guys brought Jared Taylor there to speak, of course. But tell us a little bit how this unfolded and some of the, well, I guess, outcomes of this and what the reasoning was why white students can't have a union of their own.
Well, and that was a really interesting sort of discussion on the campus. I mean, we were in the campus newspapers. Actually, one of the reporters for the Tower Light, which was our university paper, said that we were the greatest thing to happen to them that year because no one was going to the website and no one was really interested about, you know, an endless series of articles about, you know, finger painting or fraternities, you know, raising money for some cause or whatever. But people were actually interested in our story. But, you know, there was this huge discussion on campus about, you know, where do white students stand, you know, effectively. And it was a great conversation, although, you know, you mentioned where we brought Jared Taylor. And it was funny that when we brought Jared Taylor of American Renaissance to come and give a presentation, the president of the university actually came into the room that at the last minute, a day before we were holding this event, because we had the signatures we needed from interested students to present to the university. We presented our constitution and all of our paperwork, but I was told by a professor that it was sent out in his department that no professor should be the sponsor, the staff sponsor for a white student union, because it would embarrass and tarnish the reputation of Towson University. So we were not allowed to be an actual group on campus, but I think we all know if any other ethnic group tried this and was denied, and there was actually a legitimate conspiracy to prevent them from organizing on campus, that would be, you know, that'd really be a federal incident, you know, of
right.
racial discrimination.
Yeah.
So we had to organize technically as an off-campus group, and we were reserving a room for Jared Taylor to come and speak, and it was a several hundred dollar fee that we were willing to pay just to use a room for 2 hours. And a day before Jared Taylor has come to speak, the university came to me and said, you are going to have to hire security because we don't know what the student body is going to do, and they could riot. So you need to pay for about a dozen cops to come and secure the event. So they hit me with about a $3,000 bill the day before Jared Taylor was coming to speak, not because of anything we were going to do, but because they were afraid the students were going to riot. And through the generosity of American Renaissance supporters. At the 11th hour, we were able to get those resources together. So we had to pay out of pocket thousands of dollars just to have Jared Taylor come and speak about the idea that just maybe white people have a right to organize for ourselves, and maybe we have a perspective that's worth hearing. You know, if a college is supposed to be the forum where everybody is supposed to be able to exchange ideas, you can exchange any idea you want. You know, the feminist organization could go and do radical things on our campus. The Black Student Union could do whatever, really whatever they wanted. But for white students, we had to pay a ridiculous amount of money just to be able to hear, have our perspective heard for 2 hours. But the university president actually came into the event before Jared Taylor started speaking and started hugging all of the Black members who of the student body who were sitting in the room, and was actually crying, like legitimately crying, apologizing that they had to face this sort of evil racism. And I think anyone who's heard Jared Taylor talk for more than 30 seconds knows that he is a white advocate, but he's never been insulting or dismissive of any other group of people.
No.
You know, he's a race realist. And it was just kind of an amazing experience to see how entrenched the university administration was in demonizing us. Then they actually gave money to organize a diversity group on campus, in addition to the diversity union they already had established, and to hold marches on campus against the white student union. Like specifically, like giving our money, and Towson was a public university, so it's paid for not only with tuition, but by taxpayer dollars from Maryland residents, and to give hundreds and hundreds and thousands of dollars to organize against the white student union. But what was really successful about the WSU was to, one, get this conversation going on a national level about the, you know, the rights of white students to organize. But there were a lot of people who contacted me, not only on my campus, some of them who are still activists and friends who are in the movement now with me, because they were introduced through this activism, but people from all around the country and even around the world who contacted me to thank me for standing up. And, you know, they've become, at the very least, passive supporters. So I think it was a huge opportunity to be able to really challenge the establishment in, you know, on their turf, which university campuses since the 60s have been this hotbed of, you know, the system, essentially. And it gave us a huge opportunity to confront them and to mobilize people and show them that we could stand up. And, you know, my, everyone told me, you're going to ruin your life. Things are going to be horrible and miserable. But since creating the White Student Union and becoming a public advocate, I've gotten married. My wife and I just got our first child last week. And
congratulations.
Yep. Gainfully employed. Thank you. And I've been gainfully employed since since I graduated college. So it's one of those things that I feel like the system uses these fear tactics to try and tell people, because I think the majority of Europeans, whether it's in the Anglosphere or in Europe, think the way we do, but they're afraid of their lives being ruined. But I think that's a lot more bark than it has bite. You know, we need to be able to confront the enemy on their turf and to not back down and not be afraid. And it's been a very exciting couple of years, to say the least.
Yeah, very good. I mean, I saw the so-called debate, or, you know, the Q&A, I guess, after the talk as well. And I perceived that there was somehow a sense that if, you know, if whites get together, it will turn into a new NSDAP or some kind of SS organization, that somehow the activities of whites, if there are too many of them in a row, not only, mind you, that that's a microaggression in itself, but that it somehow needs to be overseen by an outsider so it doesn't go south, right?
Right. I mean, it's like in the Soviet Union. You know, my wife and I, we honeymooned in Eastern Europe and got to meet with several different nationalist parties over there. And the older folks were telling us about how, you know, even if you had a book club in the Soviet Union, you would have some sort of commissar or government informant who would stop by. And I mean, like, obviously he would be there just to monitor you. He wouldn't be interested. He'd just sit in the back and take down names and make sure that no one was up to anything against the Soviet system. And it seems to be that way in America, where you're right, where white people are not allowed to organize in any way, shape, or form, where they might be speaking about their best interests. Or even at, you know, civic nationalist events that do everything they can to be quote unquote not racist, like the Tea Party movement. You know, the system still hates that because it's white people getting together and doing something. And that's actually, with the WSU, we kind of tease the system because our student paper and several blogs, from students that, you know, were part of the so-called anti-fascist, anti-racist scene started saying that we're seeing the rise of the new American Nazi Party at Towson University, and Matthew Heimbach is the next George Lincoln Rockwell. So we actually started to tease them. And I used to put on our blog, we would do in quotes, Commander Heimbach, just to tease them, because the absurdity of the allegations against us, it was just kind of overwhelming, that we were literally just coming up and saying, hey, white students have a right to exist. And it's like, within 2 seconds, everyone says, okay, so you're a bunch of Nazis, and you're out, and you're evil, and we must destroy you. They threaten, like, we had female members that were threatened with being raped. We had some of our male members who, you know, we'd go out on campus or go to parties and stuff, and there were a couple fist fights that broke out where, you know, people actually did use, you know, physical terrorism and threats to try and intimidate white students from standing up for standing up for themselves. But they didn't win, and we're only moving forward. So I think that also shows, as the system gets more hysterical and more shrill, that it's actually showing how weak they really are. You know, people
exactly.
forget how quickly things can change. Like in Romania, Ceausescu, you know, the communist dictator, went up and started, you know, talking to his people right before his regime fell, and he thought everything was fine. And one guy started heckling him, which then spread, in,
yeah.
you know, spread into a riot. And within a week, Ceausescu and his wife, who was also a tyrant, were deposed, tried, and executed. You know, and no one would have thought 2 weeks beforehand that, you know, the communist system had existed for 50 years. There's no way it could ever fall in Romania. But just a couple people standing up crashed the entire system down, because when people talk and actually say the things most people think, it empowers other people, and then that's when you get a movement started.
Yeah, exactly. And that can, of course, go equally fast in the other direction as well. And we'll speak more about that later as we talk about the future of America and what you see in this regard. But so is there a white student union today at Towson?
Well, what we did when I graduated is we decided to join forces with Matthew Parrott, who, oddly enough, through a turn of events, now is my father-in-law, Thomas Bowles, who is a former combat Marine who got into white advocacy, Scott Terry, who is part of the Kinnis traditionalist movement in North Carolina. We kind of got all this younger generation of activists together, and we decided we wanted to create an umbrella organization to be able to advocate for the best interests of tribe, tradition, and identity. So that's how the Traditionalist Youth Network came about, that we decided that a white student union was good. But we need to also be doing this not just at Towson. We need to be doing this at college campuses around the country. We need to be attracting high schoolers to get into our sort of ideology. And we need to be using things within our communities to organize. So Trad Youth is actually more expansive than just a white student union, but it's still fighting for the same goals.
Right. So you've been called a fascist and a Nazi, as you said. I mean, and when you kind of started to look into that, tell us a little bit about what you found, because when you say that you become radicalized, it seems to me anyway that anything that has an anchoring in any kind of traditionalism really in our world today is quickly deemed to be fascist by the lefties and the conservatives alike, that somehow whatever you hold on to, if you hold on to something, it's going to be deemed that somehow that's about suppressing others or wanting to dominate them or hurt them or whatever. But were any of the labels actually applicable if you looked at the real terminology behind them?
Well, it's actually a funny thing. I started my career, and there's actually one cringeworthy interview from my first week as a YWC chapter leader, where at the time I was a Zionist because I thought that was the conservative position. You know, and I consider myself a capitalist and all these sorts of things. But again, by the left attacking me, I actually started doing research because, you know, first to try and disprove them. And then I actually started reading into the ideology and, you know, I was a history major in college and reading the history. And kind of one of the first things that hit me is when I started reading British historian David Irving's books on the Second World War. And that left me with a lot of questions because, you know, being raised in America, the Second World War is about this triumphant march forward for democracy and equality and, you know, against all the evils of Imperial Japan and the Third Reich. And you start reading history and realize that history is far more nuanced than the propaganda that's presented to you through the mass media or through the government school system. So I started to really evolve. And one thing that really started to get me was researching the Legion of St. Michael the Archangel or the Iron Guard from Romania. I was raised as a Catholic, and, you know, the modern Catholic Church in many regards has become so liberal. I was a traditionalist Catholic where I was Catholic, but not really within the good graces of the post-Vatican II Church. And I was trying to research into traditional Christianity. What was the early church? And that led me to Orthodoxy. And that's why I'm now a convert. My wife, before she met me, became a convert from Protestantism to Orthodoxy. But I found when I was researching the Iron Guard, where they were a nationalist movement, they were a traditionalist movement, and they were also an Orthodox movement. And that really inspired me. It was kind of interesting. I was reading Julius Evola, you know, one of the greatest traditionalist philosophers of the 20th century. And, you know, he had visited Nazi Germany. He had visited fascist Italy. He had visited Spain, and he visited Romania, among other countries. And he said that the Iron Guard was the truest expression of traditionalism and nationalism out of any of the movements he had seen in his time. And I took that as a really good indicator. So I started doing more research into Crinoli Cadrianu, the leader of the Iron Guard before he was murdered, and the movement itself. And that really inspired me. And many people identify it as a clerical fascist movement. You know, this synthesis between kind of church and state, where, you know, it's nationalist, it supports hierarchy and tradition, kind of this folkish sense of identity. And I guess the label became true, where I would kind of identify as a clerical fascist. But that's really a slur that's thrown around kind of against us. You know, the way I see it, as kind of Evola said, you know, my beliefs would be considered normal by any sane individual born before the French Revolution. So even within the isms of, modern 21st century politics, I consider myself a traditionalist above all, because the idea of loving your people and your God and your traditions, and your ancestors, and wanting a future for the next generation, that's just normal. I mean, you know, squirrels and apes and elephants and, you know, they fight to survive. They fight to provide for their children. You know, if animals can do it, I don't think we even need to put necessarily a political label on it, because we're doing what is normal, natural, and healthy and organic.
Well, so Matt, for people who are, I guess, at least on the surface, I guess, afraid of what you advocate, help us understand that a bit more. I mean, I think we have quite a few people with us who would agree with you on many of the issues that we're going to talk more about here. But, you know, we might also have some newcomers with us, or folks that are just, you know, tuning in to find more about you or something like that. Tell us a bit about some of the concerns that you have, what you are fighting for, and if this, in your view, is something that others should be afraid of.
Sure. Well, you know, the first thing that people always say is, you know, you're trying to return to segregation or slavery or the Third Reich, you know, whatever they can come up with from the past and just throw that on you. But as a traditionalist, what I truly believe is that every group of people has a value. Every group of people has a right to survive and a right to be able to have a future for their children and maintain their traditions, their identity, their language, and their culture. So it's actually been a very funny experience. Several of our members and myself went down after the Charleston shooting that Dylann Roof did in the Emmanuel Church, and laid flowers at the church. And join one of the morning services for the victims to pray for them and their families. And it was a very interesting moment where there were Black Panthers, there were Nation of Islam members, there were a lot of Black community leaders that were there. And we started having conversations about how we truly believe that the Black community deserves its own homeland. It deserves to be independent from rule of any other group of people, to stop any form of imperialism, whether economic or cultural. And they agreed with us. We actually had a huge amount of progress in terms of networking between Black advocates and white advocates until half a dozen white college students decided to come and start harassing us. And there was actually a very funny moment where one of the Black gentlemen we were talking to said, what are you doing attacking your brother, yelling at these white liberals? And that was a very funny moment for me. But it seems to me the only people that are afraid of what we believe are actually white liberals. It's almost a problem of kind of an inter-European civil war in terms of ideology and perspective. Because, I mean, if you really look at it, the traditionalist school of thought applies to supporting nationalist movements around the world and working with nationalist movements around the world. You know, that's why I support the right of the Palestinian people to have an independent state. You know, it's a transformation when I used to be a Zionist to, you know, being able to understand true nationalism and imperialism, and to be able to support the Palestinian right to self-determination. I also support the movements like Hezbollah that fight for the independence of Lebanon, that wanted Israel and Israeli military forces out of South Lebanon. I'm white and a Christian, and they are Arab and Muslim, but I can still find common ground to want them to be able to have a right to govern their own affairs and to be able to not have to face any sort of occupation by foreign peoples. And that includes not wanting white influence in their areas, but they should be independent. So it's kind of this funny moment that this is not the 1990s. It's not the Turner Diaries, you know, this idea of the pro-white movement where, you know, what Hollywood and the media puts up is just not correct. We love our people, our extended family, but I also love all peoples and want to be able to maintain true biodiversity. So when people hear that from different ethnic communities, there isn't a problem anymore. Like I've the only people I have truly ever had a problem with, this goes all the way back to YWC to our activism today, is not from black nationalists, not from Arab nationalists, not from Hispanic nationalists, but from self-hating white liberals and their Jewish organizers. I mean, that's it. You know? So it seems like the only people that are afraid of us are some of our own people, in all honesty.
Yeah, I mean, I think making sure that the interests of your people is upheld, and just the very aspect that you work towards, you know, those who are with you already on an ethnic basis, that's not something that is questionable or confusing, I think, to any other people except whites for some interesting reason. And I still don't know quite what that is, if we've been, brainwashed, if we have been guilt-ridden into, a historical narrative that has taken us in this direction, or if there's something within us. What's your take on that, Matthew?
I mean, what I would really say is, kind of go back to, Nietzsche when he said, God is dead. And it's the sort of perspective where I don't really think he was necessarily talking about God as a deity, but he was talking about within the European people, something had changed. I truly think the First and Second World Wars exhausted us morally. It exhausted us financially, demographically, and just kind of beat our spirits down. So what I think we're in this process of recovering and licking our wounds from the two worst conflicts that were civil wars, that were wars between brothers and sisters and one extended family. And I don't think we've fully recovered from this yet. I truly think we need to be able to come to terms with what happened during the 20th century and to be able to work so things like that never happen again. But I feel like the European spirit has been damaged in some way. And it's not beyond repair. It's not beyond fixing. But we're in a very kind of hard spot. And that's why supporting ethnic pride, cultural heritage, celebrating our victories, and honoring our defeats is an important part of being able to go through kind of those five stages of grief and be able to finally get to acceptance. Because, this self-flagellating whites have not accepted the past. They've not accepted history. And I truly feel like Europeans are going through the five stages of grief. And that's where we'll see on some parts where I think some people that think they're being white advocates go way overboard. And you look at Dylann Roof in South Carolina. I feel like he was in the stage of grief of anger. And he lashed out. But we need to be able to move to, a mature acceptance of the past and our present and be able to move towards a healthy future. So we're just we need to be able to help rehabilitate our people, for lack of a better term.
Yes, I wanted to ask you a bit more about Dylann Roof later, but I wanted to mention something else or ask you about it. Obviously we have an establishment that is very anti-white. There are disincentives against whites in many instances, despite what the mainstream media keeps telling us. However, it seems to be also in the interest of many people to make sure that white people can't have any interests or look after their interests. I don't know if you caught what happened with Bernie Sanders, of all people, up in Seattle. I mean, that's hilarious. I mean, that's a guy who's like already bending over backwards as much as he can to prove how little of a racist he is, right? And despite that, it's never going to be good enough, it seems like, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, Bernie Sanders was involved in the desegregation movement, during the 1950s and 60s. So if there's a, he's Jewish, he's of a separate ethnic group, but, in the eyes of many people, he looks white, so he is white. There's no understanding of what an ethnos or an actual people is, in which there is a biological component. It's not just how things, you know, appear on the exterior. But yeah, Bernie Sanders has done more than almost anyone in America, in the American political scene, to be able to cater for the interests of people that are not his own. But that's not enough. I mean, we're getting to the point in American society, and that is why I truly believe that balkanization is the future, where the black community, no matter how much of a white ally you are, they don't want you anymore. You know, like the Black Lives Matter protests have actually made rules that, that white allies, as they call them, are not allowed to speak on the microphones at the events, because it's not, you can come and support, but we don't need your voice anymore. You know, during the civil rights movement, there were whites and Jews who were leading most of the events, and the blacks were being used as foot soldiers, essentially. And that's now being reversed, where the black community, I think, is empowering itself and saying, we don't need anybody else. You know, so that's even Bernie Sanders, as a far leftist, as a socialist, as someone who worked, you know, for desegregation. It doesn't even matter, because he's not black, so he's not part of the community. And I think that's great. I think that is a great step for the black community to be able to take charge of itself and, you know, troll the ever-loving heck out of white and Jewish liberals. But they're taking ownership for their own political movement, and I think that's a great step forward.
So do you think that this is based on punishment on a historical basis, or is there something else going on here?
I mean, I truly think, I was actually watching Minister Farrakhan had a live stream last night, and I like to tune in and hear what black nationalists are saying. And, you know, he was talking about, you know, and it was a couple different points, and I was on the Nation of Islam website about, you know, the idea of the Nation of Islam becoming, you know, independent, essentially, where black people, when it comes to their money, they should spend them on black businesses, that they should invest in black communities, that they should grow their own food, they should make their own clothes, they should be independent. And that is truly the beginning of the creation of an independent state. So I see it as there is some degree of animosity towards the white community, but at the same time, it seems to be moving slowly but steadily towards the idea of a black consciousness, in which they realize, you know, as many of the Black Lives Matter protesters on signs refer to America as America, with three Ks.
Right.
That America is not their country, because America is not anybody's country. America is like an economic arrangement for people to come and live under the same flag, but that's not what a nation is. That's not what an identity is. So I think the black community is starting to come into its own, and it'll be interesting to see over the next couple of years how it moves towards the possibility of blacks wanting true independence and to want secession. You know, it's not just going to be Southerners with Confederate flags, which I am myself, calling for secession. I think the black community is going to be calling for it sooner rather than later.
Well, tell us a bit about the founding principles of America. You did a talk on this recently, which was very good. I listened to it again here earlier today. And I mean, if we look at the Declaration of Independence, I mean, it says, first of all, it says we hold these truths to be self-evident, meaning there's no, you know, we're not even going to debate this one, because, you know, and then it goes on to say that all men are created equal. And it's, I mean, if we try to understand why liberalism is so fervent in the United States as it is today, it's really just the natural outcome of a progression that began all the way back when the French Revolution was occurring and when the so-called sister revolution in America was taking place as well, right?
Well, exactly. I mean, America was founded, as I see it, basically as kind of a Judeo-Masonic alliance, where there's the, you know, the nationalists are based in blood and soil. It's the biological realities, it's tradition, it's faith. But the merchant class, I mean, going back to the Middle Ages, the merchant class was always antagonistic towards the royalty, towards the aristocrats. And the reason was the aristocrats' wealth and power was based in the blood and the soil. It was based on the people who they were in charge of and their land. And the merchants couldn't really crack that. So the way I see it is America is really the first example of this true rebellion against leadership, hierarchy, and nation being based around blood and soil. It became based around ideas, these ideas that, as, you know, a peasant merchant, you can rise to be the most powerful man on earth through not even doing any hard labor of your own, not having one drop of sweat leave your brow, and just moving money around and signing papers, and somehow that makes you a qualified leader. So America, by embracing these Enlightenment philosophies, really, honestly, and truly, became the first proposition nation in human history. It's never happened before. You know, if you just look at where nations are, you know, Ethiopia, it's the land of the Ethiopians. You know, Italy is the land of the Italians. You know, Russia is Russia is the land of the Russians.
Yeah.
And that's the way every nation has always been. But America came along, and the majority of the founders from the Northeast were Masons. That's not even a question. But they decided to, drink the Kool-Aid of this Enlightenment-era philosophy that was a rebellion against monarchy, the Christian faith, tradition, and biological reality, and we're just living in the results of that.
Well, I mean, America is also made up of stock that chose to leave, and that was for various reasons. Some did it for religious reasons. There were certainly problems in Europe going on at the time as well, so it isn't just as one-sided as that, but someone else pointed that out to me, which was quite interesting, that they were made up of a people that decided to go elsewhere and try their luck there, as opposed to staying in their homeland and fighting for those things. Do you think that's have given a different type of European over on the American continent?
Oh, I definitely think that we're a unique people, but you know, it's something where it's also important to understand the difference between Northerners and Southerners. If you just look at the migration, and actually Brad Griffin of Occidental Descent did a presentation at the Florida League of the South conference just about a month ago about this very topic, about how the different regions of the British Isles, where the majority of the American founding stock came from, really kind of determined the culture, where you had kind of separate groups going into the North and the South, where you had different religious traditions, where you see in the Northeast of America, you've got Puritans, you've got Quakers, and in the South, you had majority Anglicans, people that were more holding to, even though they were leaving England, they were holding to the traditions, the hierarchical church, instead of, you know, the Puritans that rebelled against all church authority and priesthood and bishops, and really just kind of wanted to be self-ruled. That's an interesting distinction. And, you know, when we think about North and South, we have to look in the traditional sense of not, you know, the far west or the Midwest, but the Northeast and the South. That I truly think that over a period, the difference in lands, the difference in culture, the difference in economy, but also the difference in founding, where the stock came from, has led to two distinct cultures that's maintained today. I mean, the South is the most conservative, it's the most Christian, it's the most ethnic, ethnocentric part of America, and that's the way it's always been, even during the American Revolution. The South were the last colonies to get on board with these New Englanders to rebel. That the Loyalist movement was strongest in the South, and in many extents, while we did secede from the British Empire, there's a lot of the British Empire left within the Southern people as part of our identity. You know, things have never really changed that much.
I'd say, therefore, as well, because of these principles you mentioned, the South is also the most hated, from New York's slimes to Hollywood movies and, you know, TV shows. They never end talking down to you know, Southerners are stupid and backwards and they're racists and blah, blah, blah. And I mean, we're talking about people who never even visited the South and they keep writing about it and sitting over in their, you know, ivory towers in Hollywood writing about this. So if there's anybody suppressed in our day and age, it's the Southern white male, I'd say.
Well, exactly. I mean, Southerners have always been hated. I mean, if you go back between the War Between the States, where in the, you know, one of the most famous incidents in congressional history in America was when Charles Sumner, who was a congressman, decided to stand up in Congress, and he insulted Southern congressmen, the South in general, and was extremely offensive in just a way that had never been seen in American history in that, 70 years. And it was kind of funny. One of the men from South Carolina, a congressman, you know, he questioned, because in the South, the tradition of dueling maintained far longer than it did in the North, as a way for gentlemen to be able to settle their grievances, whether we agree with dueling or not. I think that might be make people a little bit more polite if dueling was brought back. But this congressman decided to go, and he wasn't going to shoot Charles Sumner, because you shoot a man. So he decided to get a cane and beat him, because in his own words, you shoot a man, you beat a dog. And in Congress, actually beat Congressman Sumner unconscious because of his insult to the South. So he then resigned his position went back to South Carolina and was reelected overwhelmingly without even standing for office by the people, because they had felt under attack by the New England establishment, by these big newspapers and all these political forces. I mean, if you look during the Leo Frank, Mary Fagan case, where Leo Frank, a New York Jew, came down to Atlanta, he was running a pencil factory, paying slave wages to majority young girls who were working in his factory, and then was accused of, and I believe committed, a rape and murder mm-hmm. of a 13-year-old girl, Mary Fagan. And at the time, there was no anti-Semitism in the South. That wasn't even an issue. The Jewish community was actually rather well integrated into Southern society. But just convicting Leo Frank for rape and murder of a child, then the South faced this huge attack through the media throughout the entire United States, condemning us as being anti-Semitic and hate mongers, and the list goes on, and pressure being put on the governor, who eventually commuted Leo Frank's sentence, saying they're going to flood money into Southern politics to buy off our politicians, all these sorts of things that, of course, Southern men then stood up and hung Leo Frank, fulfilling the original sentence passed by the jury of, condemning him to death for rape and murder. But, they still haven't forgotten about that. There was a Broadway musical just a few years ago rehashing the evil, racist, anti-Semitic Southerners called Parade. That was, of course, written by a New York Jew who probably has never been to Atlanta in his entire life. He might have different views of diversity if he'd ever been there. But, Southerners have always been under attack. That there is a huge cultural, ideological, and religious difference between Northerners and Southerners. We are a distinct people, and we fought a war to prove that we are a distinct people. And while we lost, that doesn't delegitimize the sacrifice of hundreds of thousands of men that gave their lives for that dream and that ideal. So, yeah, we've always been under attack. Most of the time, we don't even do anything to deserve it. But Southerners always seem to rise to the occasion to defend our honor and to defend our families and our homes and our traditions. And that's what we see now in America with all these Confederate flag rallies that are being held. There have been hundreds around the South with tens of thousands of participants to say, we don't care what your political correctness is in Hollywood or New York. This flag is a part of our heritage. This flag was, was created through the sacrifice of hundreds of thousands of men's honorable blood to fight for a dream. So we don't care what you say. We're going to keep flying our flag. And Confederate flag sales, even though eBay and Amazon and all these other places have banned sale of Confederate flag items, Confederate flag sales through small, locally owned Southern businesses are through the roof. People can't keep them in stock now. So once again, Southerners are standing up and saying, hey, we don't care what you think. We're going to stand up for ourselves.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting things that kind of connect right there. I mean, you probably have a different view of the Civil War, of course. We've done a couple of shows about the lies on that. But, I mean, regarding the attack on Southern heritage, since the Charleston shooting has obviously gone up as well, and interestingly that actually in Charleston you have the root of the Scottish Rite on the American continent. The first lodge was set up in a basement, I think it was a bar or something like that, on Broad Street. And I think even the first synagogue was actually in Charleston as well. There was obviously a lot of religious freedom supposedly here, from the Huguenots to Jews, and all these people came here. So obviously the truth is somewhat kind of convoluted here. But how would you say that things have changed after the Charleston shooting? I mean, that's really what's ramped all of this up. Is statues are being taken down. We saw everything with the flag, of course, in the state house there at Columbia. But, more than that, churches are being renamed. Old generals are being dug up. I mean, that's how you conquer a nation. You tear down their statues, right?
Well, and that's an interesting point, that if you look after the war between the states, the North, as part of a kind of a period of reconciliation, let us have our statues, let us have our symbols. Even in the American, congressional building, that they have a statue of Jefferson Davis and several other Confederate leaders who were Southern statesmen who stand because the states, donated a statue of someone they felt was important, and that currently stands. But the North, as much as I obviously object to their war, was at least somewhat gracious and at least leaving us our dignity. To a certain extent, that while we were a conquered people, we were an occupied people, especially after the Reconstruction era ended into the early 20th century, they left us our dignity. And that was, I think, an important thing, and I can appreciate that. But where we see in this post-Charleston shooting era, that the center is being destroyed. And that is, I think, the reality of American politics and even European politics in the 21st century, is the center cannot hold. The center cannot provide answers to a lot of these questions that people are asking, whether it's economic or social or historical. The moderates, whether moderate left or moderate right, really can't answer any of these questions for people. So the center is kind of being blown apart. And on one side, you have, you know, Southerners that are willing to, raise the Confederate flag against what the media and the establishment tells them to do and say, we're going to stand for heritage. And on the flip side, you've got protesters that are calling to burn all Confederate symbols, to ban the Confederate flag. I've seen some petitions to ban it as hate speech. So you couldn't even be allowed to fly it, which I've got a Confederate battle flag tattooed on my arm. So I guess they're going to have to try and blowtorch it off. I wouldn't suggest that for anyone else for their benefit, but it's not coming off is all I'm going to say.
Right.
But we're seeing the disintegration of the center and the radicalization of politics. People are moving to the far left or the far right, or towards identity versus globalism, where the idea of America as this globalist, diverse place where you can't offend anybody is on one side, and people that say, no, I'm going to stick to my roots, I'm going to stick to my heritage and my identity, is also on the rise. So I think this is a great opportunity for Southerners and for all people to really kind of start asking these questions about, first and foremost, what is an American? And then secondly, what am I? Who am I? You know, am I the 50-star flag and apple pie and hot dogs and hamburgers? Or do I come from a people? Do I come from a heritage? Do I have a culture? If the answer is yes, then you need to not consider yourself an American, first and foremost. You need to see yourself, whether you're a black nationalist in Ferguson, Missouri, that doesn't feel represented, by the legislature and the community, stop identifying as an American. If you're a Southerner in Alabama or Mississippi or Maryland or Virginia, and you feel like your heritage under attack, which it is, as you said, they're trying to dig up Nathan Bedford Forrest's grave and his wife's grave. The New Orleans Historical Committee just voted to remove all these Confederate statues and symbols from New Orleans, that they are trying to wage an ISIS-style campaign of destroying history.
Yeah.
So if you see that and you don't like it, you need to stand up and do something. And I had the honor of being able to speak at a Confederate flag rally in Knoxville, Tennessee, a couple weeks ago, and it was amazing. I was able to give a talk, and, you know, I started promoting secession. And you would think, I've been going to a lot of rallies, since I was just a conservative, going to Republican rallies, Tea Party events, and no one would think secession was on the table 5 years ago or even 3 years ago. But now, quote unquote, normal people who aren't involved in the movement in any way, shape or form, but are just normal working class white folks, are starting to come around to the idea of maybe the American empire isn't for me. And maybe there's a different future than just, you know, watching the slow decline demographically, socially and culturally of my people. And that's an exciting it's an exciting time to be an advocate. It's kind of a scary time because the pressure of history and quickly changing politics and, of course, the potential for persecution by the regime is there. But it's also an exciting time because I truly feel like the wheels of history are finally starting to turn after many years of being rusted shut. And it's going to be, hardworking men and women who are willing to come together. They're going to make those wheels start going faster and faster.
Yeah, danger and opportunity both at the same time. But, I mean, demographically, European Americans are being displaced. I mean, their interests are not really represented. And as you said before, the founding stock, and you know, sure, we can have a debate about, you know, the conquering that went on in the Americas with the different tribes that were here, et cetera. This is just how business was done at the time. I think we cannot view that in the same way we view today. Allegedly today, they think it's, you know, wrong to conquer. At the same time, we have a kind of a softer version of that is happening with these large population movements and migration and you know, the demographic question kind of going on in itself, both in Europe and America too. But my point there is that a lot of the people that are coming in, they're not doing it on the same basis that the Europeans did when they came. There wasn't a structured, organized, state apparatus in place where you could go to get help, for example, if nothing. I mean, this was live or die, and many people died sacrificing themselves to get to America, to set something up, to try and achieve something that was different. And then at the same time, now we're in a time where, many people are coming in, they don't have that association to it. They don't really care about the background. They don't care about the heritage or the blood, for that matter, that was spilt from these people. So, I mean, European Americans are definitely being displaced in their own country that they built and set up.
Well, I think one of the most interesting demonstrations of what you're saying is if you look at national parks. Now, growing up in Maryland, I was only a couple hours drive from pretty much all of the War Between the States sites. I went to Gettysburg probably half a dozen times as a child. My father was a history teacher and you know, always encouraged me to be interested about history. So going to national parks, you know, of course, they're free, most of them. So that was an important part of my childhood, going and seeing these sites. And whether you're a Union sympathizer or Confederate sympathizer, to see these battlefields and honor the men that gave their lives and their limbs there for something they believed in was, you know, it's part of your roots. It's part of who we are. And it's something, if you look at national park attendance, it's almost overwhelmingly white. And secondly, park attendance is dropping, almost dropping exactly if you look at the demographics of the decline of America. And they've run all these campaigns. I lived in Baltimore, and the federal government had billboard campaigns telling the black residents of Baltimore, you know, come and visit all these you know, different historical sites and parks and things like that. But they don't care. I mean, am I truly supposed to believe that, like, a Guatemalan immigrant that shows up is going to want his tax dollars, you know, in 25 years to go towards maintaining Gettysburg or, you know, Sharpsburg or, you know, any of these battlefields or parks that historically mean something to us because it was our blood that was shed there. It's our heritage, you know, win or lose there. It's still part of our history. It's not part of his history. And whether it's with support for federal parks or attendance, it's become very clear that the new changing demographics of America do not care whatsoever for, you know, for the history that's here. And that's what we're going to see. I think we're going to see parks in 25 years be turned into Walmarts and taco stands and low-income housing because the people there don't care about it anymore. So why would they maintain it?
Exactly. Yeah, and it'll be probably a population upswing as well. Just a tremendous amount of what is like 1 million, you know, legally they take into America every year. They want to raise it, of course, and then there you have the illegal immigration and whatnot. And it's like this is going to take a hard hit on the country, even just based on infrastructure. I mean, we have the same thing happening in Sweden right now, where we have basically no housing to the immigrants that come in. I mean, it's to a point where it's absurd now, where old people are being kicked out of their elderly care places to give room to immigrants and whatnot. They have a plan to build over 600,000 new you know, apartments and houses in Sweden just to be able to house the immigrant population that comes in. And that's basically like building another capital city, Stockholm, over again just to take care of this problem. And it's just, I mean, where is it going to end when the whole rest of the world has come to Europe and America because somehow it's a human right to have access to, you know, what we have in the Western world or something, you know?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, the Washington Examiner had a report just a couple days ago that said that they're estimating there's actually 42.1 million Hispanic immigrants, legal and illegal, in America. 42.1 million. That is insane in a country of, you know, about 330 million because, of course, the higher birth rates and increasing the immigration, both legal and illegal, it's only ramping up. So we need to understand that if I take things from a Christian perspective, and the Bible tells me that he who does not take care of his family, those of his own house, is worse than a non-believer, that I truly see a biblical commandment to take care of my immediate family, my wife and my child come first, but then my extended family. And then, of course, it can go out there. You know, if we've got a surplus of food, I don't think we should let it rot. I think we could send that for humanitarian aid and stuff like that. But you have a duty to take care of your immediate family and your extended family. You know, it would go from me to my family, to my folk, to then all Europeans, and then outward from there in these, you know, kind of circles of influence. But, yeah, I mean, what we're seeing is there is no plan. I mean, unless the only plan is total and utter demographic displacement and destruction of the European people, that, you know, we did a protest against Tim Wise, who is a very famous in America as an anti-racist campaigner, and he's spoken at thousands of colleges. He's given thousands of speeches across America, and, of course, he always gets on the media and his book's published and whatnot. But when we were protesting one of his speeches, one of the white counter-protesters said that because of white guilt, and we have this on video, it's online, because of white guilt, that white people should just accept genocide. We just need to accept being replaced. Like, yeah. If that's what needs to happen, we just need to accept it. And I told him, I said, well, if you think white people deserve to die, then put a gun in your mouth and pull the trigger and start with yourself. And, that was a little, we just got attacked by quote unquote anti-fascists right before the events. My blood was up a little bit. I tried to be more professional in my presentation, but, it's just so insane. This idea of this white guy, looking at me and saying all white people need to die. And it's like, all right, pony up and, lead the way.
Yeah.
Be the first lemming off the cliff then. But, that's the message being pushed, especially white youth, that we need to accept our own genocide. Genocide doesn't have to be with tanks and bombs. It can be demographic. It can be cultural. And that's what's currently happening. And that's why either our leaders have no plan and are just clueless buffoons, which I don't think. I think they're way smarter than that. So I truly believe in the best example of a conspiracy. There is a conspiracy between the global elites to use demographic displacement, not just of Europeans too, but around the world, to move these population groups away from their soil that they're grounded on, and to destroy a majority of any population in one area. So then essentially everyone becomes, kind of a servant on the plantation of the globalist elites. And that's something, again, why the struggle needs to be nationalist versus globalist. And I can unite with different ethnic groups that are fighting for their sovereignty and their own homelands, because they're going to get steamrolled just like we are, and within the white community, again, I'm a Christian, but I also support my comrades that are not religious or folk religionists, because like folk religionists are under attack in the media too for being, folk religion is racist and evil and needs to be banned. I've seen some things in Europe that saying that Asatru needs to be banned. And I'm a European. Yeah. I'm a Christian. But at the same time, I see that different traditions than my own are also being placed under attack. And that seems to me to be the global plan, is to destroy any faith, family, and folk, any identity, whether it's ethnic, religious, or cultural, that people might have by using, moving massive amounts of people around through endless global propaganda. That is the goal, to destroy all nationalism around the planet.
Yep, seems like it. Well, I'm not in question of that anymore. I'm utterly convinced of it. I mean, people are moving towards becoming rootless and consequently confused, and the only thing that's going to unite them is this pile of garbage that we call pop culture and basically nothing less within it. It's obviously it's obvious that Europeans are being hit the hardest at this point. And it doesn't mean that they won't turn to another one if and when they're done with us, which I don't think they're going to be. But nonetheless, this is definitely in the works, And Matthew, we're going to take a break here in a little bit. We can pick up and talk more about this in a second. There's a lot more interesting things I want to ask you about here. But just tell us a bit about Traditionalist Youth Network, how people can follow you more regularly, give out some of the websites, and let us know if there's anything else you'd like to let our audience know about.
Sure. Well, anyone who wants to follow us over at the Traditionalist Youth Network can join us at tradyouth.org. So that's www.tradyouth.org. And you can go ahead, and we have articles up almost every single day for, with new content, perspectives, also keeping people updated on our activism. If you're on Facebook, you can join us at www.facebook.com/tradyouth.org and join our Facebook community. We do a lot of memes, music. We share our articles, join our conversations. And if anybody, wants to go ahead and follow me, if you want to, I don't know why you would. I don't think I'm that interesting, but.
Oh, you're interesting. You have a lot of good things to say and a lot of things to share with us. So.
Well, thank you. You can go ahead and join me at twitter.com/MatthewHeimbach. And you can follow me on Twitter and, find my 3 a.m. random thoughts, stay up on our activism, and follow us, especially any listeners who are in the West Virginia area. We're planning to protest once again Tim Wise, who is giving a speech at a diversity conference that's being held in West Virginia on Friday, September 11th. So follow us over at the website, Facebook page, or Twitter. We'll have details if anyone wants to come and join us. And I guess a good hook for the break is one thing we're also working on is trying to create a political party to be able to advocate for the best interests of white Americans, because we are not politically being represented as it stands. And while I do not have the hope that we're going to quote-unquote retake America, we need to be able to use politics to advance our agenda. and to be able to fight for our people. So that's the hook. The Traditionalist Worker Party is a group we're currently working on, and we'd love folks' input as we start to get it off the ground. So that's the hook.
Very good. Well, the Trad Worker Party, I wanted to ask you more about that in the second, because the prospect of more and more immigration coming into the United States and Europe surely should be driving some of these people that have been looking to the left for salvation away from that when they realize that people, you know, are not supportive at all, you know, within those political parties of the workers of that nation, you know. So that's a really, you know, good angle and important thing we should talk more about. But folks, in the meantime, then tradyouth.org is the website. We'll have that up. We'll also have the link to Matthew's Twitter, as he mentioned. But yeah, stay with us, everybody. Stay with us. Matthew, we'll take a short break, and then we'll be right back with more.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, please check out redicemembers.com for the second hour coming up with Matthew Heimbach. We do not run ads on the website or commercial interruptions in our program. We have a member section, and when you want to hear more, please acquire a membership and get full access to our archives. The first and second hour of all our shows, over 1,000 programs now. We have been going since 2006. The second hour here coming up is a great continuation. We get into secession, demography, underreported violence against whites in the media, and how they're whipping up this animosity and ultimately violence. When the roles are reversed, however, we never end hearing about it. Structural racism, white supremacy reign supreme. We talk a bit about the Black Lives Matter campaign and Dylann Roof as well, among many other topics. We end asking Matthew about Europe, the homeland, what he feels about this in the struggle, and if he would fight for it if necessary. We say thank you for listening to the first hour. We'll be back here after the break with the second. RedIceMembers.com is the website. We'll talk to you on the other side.